Good day, everyone, and welcome to the South Carolina Medicaid Waiver Press Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and 1 on your telephone keypad. Please note that this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to the Communications Director for the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, Kathy Hope. Please go ahead.
Thank you, David, and happy 2019 to everyone. It's a new year, but in the world of health policy, it seems a lot like last year. Just before the holiday break, South Carolina became the latest state to propose a waiver that would impose work requirements on Medicaid beneficiaries. Today, we are going to release a report on how this waiver would impact South Carolina families if it is allowed to go forward. The report is embargoed until noon today, when it will be posted on our website. So Medicaid waivers can get very complicated very quickly, but fortunately we have a national expert on Medicaid waivers here with us today, as well as a South Carolina expert to walk us through this latest proposal. Our first speaker will be Joan Elker. She is the founder and executive director here at the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University, and she's also a research professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy. And our second speaker will be Sue Berkowitz. Sue is the director of the South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice Center, and she also serves on the South Carolina Medical Care Advisory Committee. Now I'm going to turn the call over to Joan Elker.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. This is Joan Elker speaking, and I'm going to walk through some of what the state is proposing, put it in context, and highlight a few of our report findings. South Carolina is seeking to impose new work-related reporting rules for very low-income parents and caretaker relatives with incomes below 67% of the poverty line who are insured through Medicaid. Because South Carolina has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, these parents are the only adults on Medicaid who are not severely disabled and by definition unable to work. So when you hear proponents of this proposal talking about applying this to able-bodied adults, just keep in mind that we're only talking about parents here. That's it. These are very vulnerable families whose income is no more than $1,160 a month for a family of three. If the federal government gives its approval, the state will be able to terminate Medicaid coverage for parents who do not successfully navigate a new bureaucratic maze to report 80 hours of work or related activities every month. Some might lose coverage because they weren't meeting the 80-hour work rule, but others would lose coverage simply because they were unaware of the new rules and how to comply with them or had not successfully sought an exemption. The stated goal of this policy is to help families' health status by boosting employment. This is a worthy goal. However, the proposed policy will not achieve either of these goals. In fact, it will have the opposite effect. The proposal will do nothing to ensure that barriers low-income women face to employment, such as affordable and high-quality childcare, transportation, and the lack of available jobs, particularly in rural communities, will be addressed. And the federal government has been clear that no new funding is available to address these issues. Moreover, if these women did find low-wage jobs, they would likely not be offered affordable health insurance. Only 17% of workers living below the poverty line in South Carolina have employer-sponsored health insurance. It is certain, however, that more parents will become uninsured if the federal government approves this proposal. Research is very clear that being uninsured is bad for your health. Having less access to needed health services, such as medications to control chronic conditions, such as depression or high blood pressure, will create new barriers to work, not fewer. In addition, losing health insurance exposes these families to more medical debt and deeper poverty, and puts children at risk of going uninsured as well. Currently, the state is taking public comment on this proposal until January 22nd. The state is required to include a summary of those public comments and how they have responded to them in its submission to the federal government. The federal government will then also hold a 30-day public comment period before rendering a decision. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the part of the federal government that will render the decision, has yet to respond to a request to impose a work requirement from a state like South Carolina that has not expanded Medicaid under the ACA. The parents targeted by South Carolina and other states with similar requests, which include Alabama, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and South Dakota, are a mandatory population under federal law, unlike the expansion population. As many of you know, one expansion state, Arkansas, is currently implementing work reporting requirements, and approximately 17,000 people have already lost health coverage in the last few months of 2018 there. Also clear from the Arkansas data is that most of these folks are not losing coverage because they aren't working, but rather because they are unaware of or getting tripped up by the bureaucratic red tape. In fact, less than 1% of those subject to the work reporting rules in Arkansas are newly reporting work activities. So the policy is clearly failing to achieve its purported goal of supporting work. South Carolina does acknowledge that some parents will lose coverage under its plan, but you need a calculator and a fair bit of experience reading the fine print of Section 1115 budget neutrality documents to figure that out. On page 8 of the proposal, the state writes, quote, accounting for the non-primary child caregiver, non-elderly, and non-working population, 7% of remaining members are estimated to not fall into other compliance exemption categories based on KFF national estimates. This is a population removed from enrollment figures due to the waiver's implementation. Translation, the state projects in the accompanying table that an annual equivalent of approximately 1,600 parents would lose coverage in the first year, and about 3,000 would lose coverage by year 5 if the new rules are implemented. The state's projections, if you can figure them out, are way too low in our judgment. We estimate that between 5,000 to 14,000 parents would lose coverage in the first year, and by the fifth year of implementation, enrollment would be reduced by 9,000 to 26,000 parents as compared to current projections of enrollment. Who are these families? Our analysis found that the vast majority are mothers, 86%, and they are disproportionately African American. Families living in rural areas and small towns would be harder hit as well, which would have ripple effects on rural hospitals and other providers in these communities. These families are living in deep poverty and suffer high rates of residential instability, making it harder to comply with complex bureaucratic demands. Children will also be harmed if parents lose coverage. As parents become uninsured, research is clear that children are more likely to not have coverage as well. An insured parent almost never has an uninsured child, but a parent who doesn't have coverage raises the odds the child too will be uninsured. This is very troubling, especially in South Carolina, because as our recent report on children's coverage rates found, South Carolina was one of 9 states to see a significant rise in the number of uninsured children in 2017 for the first time after many years of steady progress. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Sue Berkowitz, and we'll be happy to take your questions after Sue concludes her remarks. Sue?
Thank you, Joan. And I want to thank you and Georgetown CCF for all your hard work on this report. We could not do our work without you. I want to say that I'm very disappointed in our state Medicaid agency for pursuing this waiver. First, for the fact that they're targeting low-income families and ultimately harming children in our state, but also for the way they've gone about doing this. I was, as a member of the Medical Care Advisory Committee, we were updated that this waiver would be initiated, and I specifically asked during that meeting that nothing be done before the end of the year, because we do want to make sure that everybody in South Carolina has an opportunity to provide comment and voice their concerns to the agency about this particular waiver. And doing so during the Christmas holiday when many offices are closed and it's harder to communicate with people around the state would limit the opportunity for a robust comment and robust input. And we think that this was not done by accident but actually done on purpose. We know that it will only impact our very low-income parents in our state. These are struggling families, as Joan pointed out, mostly moms. And we know that when there's a huge when there is a lack of health care among parents, we know that that ultimately harms children. We'll be adding additional bureaucracy to what had been a fairly easy program for people to be able to enroll into and stay on, but adding a difficult level of bureaucracy, especially after our state has finally gotten back on track with their new computer system after seeing multiple problems when they launched this computer system, and they finally have enrollment back under control. Not only will we be adding red tape, but we'll be adding additional burdens onto families in areas that we know they have access to health care automatically because of the rural areas that they're in. We know there's a huge gap in the ability for working families to access child care assistance, and there are fewer jobs in these areas. There's transportation problems, and when we talk about layering on what is now being called community engagement, it adds to the instability of the families for their ability to hold on to these jobs. Once families are employed, they should not be asked to be submitting additional paperwork. They should not be asked to be documenting. And more importantly, we know in a state like South Carolina, which is a right-to-work state, parents can be terminated for no reason or any reason whatsoever. Something as simple as having a sick child and not being able to come in, or having transportation problems and running late for your job, can allow you to lose your job permanently, even though it's due to no fault of your own. Having your job lost is bad enough, but then also having your health insurance at risk is unconscionable for our state to be making that happen for our families. This instability is not just for the workers, but this instability will also go to employers, where we know we already have a real problem with having a trained workforce, and this is just going to exacerbate problems that are already going on in our rural areas. I was so proud of the state of South Carolina up until 2 years ago. When we would talk about our uninsured children's rate, we could talk about we were doing better than the rest of the country. Unfortunately, that has changed. As Georgetown reported last year, we have one of the higher rates of increase in child uninsured rates, and we cannot continue that trend. We need to be doing everything we can to helping to provide stability to families, especially in our rural, underemployed areas, and to make sure that all of our children have the ability to succeed. This continuing trend of trying to put red tape and to make it more difficult for families to hold on to their insurance while they're already struggling in day-to-day life is not just inappropriate, but unconscionable, and should not be happening in our state. We're going to work with partners around the state to ensure in the short period of time that the agency is now giving us because of doing this over the holiday period to get the comments that they will have to take into account. And hopefully, when our policymakers see what's going on with our state agency, we can turn this around and keep the waiver from fully being implemented. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. So that was Sue Berkowitz with South Carolina Appleseed Legal Justice Center speaking. And our first speaker today was Joan Elker with the Center for Children and Families. So David, would you like to explain how the reporters on today's call can ask questions?
Absolutely. If you'd like to ask a question today, please press the star and one keys on your telephone keypad. Keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question today, please press the star and one keys on your touch-tone telephone keypad. And we'll pause a moment to allow questions to queue.
While we're waiting for questions to queue up, there was a lot of information. As everybody knows, Medicaid waivers get very complicated, and one of the heart of the matter is really how many people we expect to lose coverage. And Joan, you went over some of that in your comments. Do you want to run by what the estimates that you have in your report on in the key findings on how many people you expect would lose coverage?
Sure. So I can just say a couple more things about that. As I mentioned, the state itself is expecting coverage losses here, but it's very hard to figure that out. They don't really say that clearly, but they do, and you have to do some math because they do it on a member month basis. So you divide that by 12 to get an annualized projection. So they're projecting about 1,600 parents losing coverage in the first year. So what we did was, and just by way of comparison, in Arkansas, that I mentioned, where this policy is the only state in the country being implemented, so far we're seeing 22% of those affected losing coverage. So that is dramatically higher than 2%. The state talks about 7%, but that's actually a little bit misleading because they're taking 7% off a smaller number. And of the entire affected population, it's actually 2%, their projection. So what we did was we used some national kind of estimates and methodologies developed by researchers at the Kaiser Family Foundation, who looked at previous research and studies looking at TANF and SNAP, and came up with this range. That's what Kaiser recommends, a 16 to 17% range of adults who would lose coverage, and we applied that number to South Carolina's parent population. So that's how we came up with our numbers. I'll just mention that nobody, the state nor us, has made any projection here about how many children might lose coverage. Those numbers relate only to parents, but of course, as I mentioned, we would expect that some children would lose coverage or perhaps not get enrolled in the first place. Because part of this is about when you hear a lot of negative publicity, the state's, you know, not going to make Medicaid available anymore to you unless you're working, even though there are exemptions, for example, say for a parent under age six, the word gets out that it's harder to get Medicaid. And then there's a lot of confusion, and this has been a phenomenon we're seeing nationwide for other reasons, that children lose coverage, even though they're still eligible. So,
and South Carolina has already been slipping?
South Carolina has already been slipping. Our annual report this fall found nationally the number went backwards for the first time in almost a decade, and South Carolina was one of the nine states that had one of the sharpest increases. So that's very concerning.
Okay, and something like this would be presumably make matters worse.
Yes, we would certainly expect this to make matters worse. Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any questions in the queue?
Yes, we do. And we'll take our first question from Lauren Saucer with the Post and Courier. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. I spoke with the agency earlier this week, and they said that they had received two comments so far during the public comment period pertaining to the waiver. Can you all give me a sense of how that compares to the number of comments received in other states that are further along in this process?
That is extremely low, and I think that reflects exactly what Sue was talking about, which is that it happened over Christmas and nobody knew about it. We'll have to see where things end up on January 22nd. I would certainly expect that number to go up, and Sue can jump in. We've seen a range in terms of the number of comments, but in Mississippi, the first time it came out, there were very few comments because hardly anybody knew about it. There were only maybe 11, but the next time that it came out for federal comment in Mississippi, there were almost 400. And
okay.
Alabama, there were maybe 800, 900, you know, so, and we've seen some states, Kentucky, for example, which is involved in litigation, the feds recently took public comment again, and I think they got 11,000. So,
okay.
So two is not a good number. Sue, do you want to jump in?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple things that, you know, as I said on the onset is, one, the agency, first, I got it a text from someone just the other day saying, I thought at the MCAC meeting the agency said that they would notify the entire MCAC that they were actually putting the waiver up for comment. And I had to text back and say, yes, they did say that, but no, they did not notify anybody on the MCAC, which would have only been about 30 or 40 individuals who are on that distribution list, but they didn't notify anyone. I even went onto their website and did an inquiry onto the website, seeing if I could find whether or not the waiver was up there. And I'm not sure where it was buried, but it wasn't showing when I was putting in a general inquiry. So I'm not so sure that the low number of comments isn't by design and not by accident. So that's why we are going to start notifying individuals, and hopefully we can, well, I don't think we could get to 11,000 in a short period of time. We know that there are people who have been waiting and are concerned. We just also understood that if we tried to start doing any kind of major campaign to let people know during the Christmas holidays, that was not going to be fruitful, and I think the agency realized that.
Okay, David, we're ready for the next question.
And as a reminder, to ask a question, please press the star and one keys on your telephone keypad. We'll take our next question from Jamie Self with the State Newspaper. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey there. Thank you. I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about what exactly Medicaid recipients in South Carolina who are affected by these new requirements would have to do and how often? I mean, would they have to fill out paperwork every 2 weeks or once a month? Do we have a sense of that?
Sue, do you want to start on that and then I can jump in?
Well, I mean, you know, from the waiver itself, they're going to have to be able to show that they're meeting the 80 hours a month requirement. So it would be, which could be pretty problematic because we know that, especially when we're looking at the counties that are going to be most affected, the rural counties and low-wage jobs, these are often people that are hourly wage workers and don't always have consistent wages. So I think it could end up being somewhat problematic for folks, especially because I'm not sure the agency is even equipped to take this kind of information.
Yeah, so I mean, there's discussion in the document about how they're going to leverage existing information technology infrastructure and try to use that to identify exemptions. It's a very good question that you ask, and I think a really important question to ask the state, because if they really wanted to do this in a way that the families impacted knew about it, understood what was going on, understood these very complicated rules and all the exemptions, and the providers who served them understood them all, that would require a lot of money for the state to spend on administrative costs to roll this out. So I think that's a really important question as to how much they are intending to spend to roll this out. They could end up spending a lot of money, and it still wouldn't be enough so that they could reach these families in remote rural areas so they understand what's going on. Okay,
yeah,
do we have any? Go ahead, Sue.
I think that there's no doubt that that's why their calculations as to the number of people who would be impacted is you know, just something that is not credible at all. I think that, in fact, looking at what's going on in Arkansas, when we think about what it's really going to take for folks to be able to comply, we are going to see just people dropping off, unfortunately, because it's just going to be impossible for them to understand how to get that information in. We also know that the agency, when they tried to do streamlining with a computer system, how hard it was for them to keep up and how they had a backlog for, you know, literally years trying to get themselves under control, what we're going to end up seeing is something that's not dissimilar to what we saw in TANF, where people just give up and stop utilizing a particular benefit because it's too difficult. And also when we saw with the SNAP program, where caseworkers did not understand, nor did the agency understand really how to implement a bureaucratic work requirement and how to exempt folk, we ended up seeing people just removed from the program, not necessarily because they should have been removed, but because the agency just could not understand and how to keep up with it. Now, granted, they are two separate agencies, but we've got a Medicaid agency that's never had to deal with actual social working, case working the way they would have to with the proposal that they've got right now as they're proposing for the community engagement. It just seems virtually impossible that they would be able to keep up with it as an agency. And if the agency can't keep up with it, how can we expect for the beneficiaries to be able to comply?
Does that answer your question, Jamie?
Yeah, thank you. And I guess in Arkansas, do we know how often, Sue, you mentioned issues with folks not being able to comply there. Do you know how often in Arkansas they're required to submit paperwork?
Every month they have to.
Once a month, okay.
Yeah, and they actually have to do it online in Arkansas.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Which, in, as we know, in our rural areas, there's conductivity problems. We know our unemployment insurance system has required that people do a lot of their work through a computer system, and we saw when that rolled out, literally tens of thousands of people lost benefits because the system itself couldn't wasn't working appropriately, as well as people just did not understand how to utilize the system.
Okay, thank you. David, is there another question in the queue?
Yes, there is. We'll take our next question from Santaya Rahman with CQ Roll Call. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. Could you talk a little bit about this specifically affecting a non-expansion state? Are there other states kind of like South Carolina that are pursuing work requirements that are in a kind of similar boat? You mentioned that CMS hasn't approved a waiver for a state like this yet, so I was just curious about that.
Sure, yes. There are, and I hope I'm remembering them all. My colleagues can tell me if I've forgotten one, but there are four states who are also considering this proposal that are non-expansion states. Those are Mississippi and Alabama, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. And Mississippi and Alabama and South Dakota, I believe, have all gone through the state comment period and the federal comment period. So is that right, Olivia? Yes. So those three, in theory, CMS could render a judgment on them any day. Now, I will note for the record that I believe much of the Justice Department is furloughed right now. And particularly on a matter such as this, because I think it raises major legal issues. I'm not a lawyer, so I will take this with a grain of salt. But considering that a judge has already rendered a decision that the Kentucky decision was arbitrary and capricious, we're talking about a population here, as I mentioned, that is a mandatory population under Medicaid law. And essentially, many of these folks would no longer have a path to Medicaid if this were approved. So I think it is clearly, you know, to me, it would not be legal for them to do this. But again, I'm not a lawyer. But they obviously would have to at least have a legal strategy in mind to defend such a decision. Oklahoma is the other state that has moved their proposal through state public comment, and currently the federal government is accepting public comment on Oklahoma's proposal.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Okay, David, do we have any other questions?
And there are no further questions on the line at this time, so I'll return the call to Kathy Hope.
Okay, thank you everybody for participating in our call today. The embargo on this report will lift at noon Eastern Standard Time. It will go live on our website at that time. Hopefully you've all received an embargoed copy of the report, but if you haven't, you can shoot me an email at Catherine, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, .hope, H-O-P-E, at georgetown.edu. We've also recorded today's call, and I will have a copy of the call by the end of business today and can send you out that recording. Thank you very much.